And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And yes, we were at the great event for Charles Roach yesterday at the Medical Science Building in Toronto. It ran long. It ran musical. It ran oratory. It was great. So, and I got to tell you, today we're going to talk to Elias Amari from Ethiopia. About the situation in Ethiopia. I should not say he's from Ethiopia. He's from the Horn of Africa. I'm not actually sure of his direct origins. He's a scholar. And we're going to find out about some dramatic events there. And at the halfway point, we have a very important interview with Cynthia Hess von Kreudner. She is the widow of Major Peter Kress von Heudner, Kreudner. And he was her husband. The major was serving in the United Nations on an outpost at the time of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Thousands and thousands were killed. He was a UN observer together with others in a post that had been clearly marked and been functional for 30 years. And that post was shelled by the Israelis and later suffered a direct hit and the Canadian Army major was killed. Many, many people have asked questions over the years about this. And Cynthia Hess von Kreudner is going to talk to us at 5:30 about her thoughts of what occurred there that day and questions that remain unanswered. I think that those questions might be put under the list of what happened to the U.S. Liberty ship, which was attacked by the Israeli forces in 1967. And to this day, it remains a kind of, I call that a ghost ship, as though don't ask. But that's an important part of our political reality, so we have to know that. We are joined now by Elias Amari, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you, Phil. How are you doing?
Good. We do a lot of reporting on this program of matters which we think do not get sufficient attention in the mainstream media. While the world has been talking a great deal about Syria and all kinds of actions to be taken or not taken, and they talk about Egypt and the great demonstrations and what to make of those things, my understanding is there's been a tremendous demonstration in Ethiopia, I believe in Addis Ababa, and it hasn't been well reported. I have to say that by that I mean I didn't hear of it. Can you tell us about that and what is behind it?
It's my pleasure, Phil. Good to connect with you once again. As you said, uncertainty looms large in Ethiopia. Just a week ago, there was a massive uprising, popular demonstration in Addis Ababa, just as the African Union. And Ethiopian Muslim protesters turned out in huge numbers, some estimate close to 250,000, to demonstrate against the regime's repressive measures of interfering in their religious affairs. And this was quite unique in a long time since the last 2005 rigged election when the minority regime of Meles Zenawi stole in broad daylight the elections and crushed peaceful demonstrations in broad daylight, massacred over 200 demonstrators simply for demonstrating against the rigged election and stolen election.
Yeah. Now you mentioned Elias that this had this religious component. I don't think people know much about this. We know that Ethiopia is a close ally of the U.S. and generally, when Ethiopia is spoken of, it's thought of as a Christian, dominant Christian. What is the demographics of Ethiopia?
Good question, Phil. The demographics in Ethiopia is actually 50-50. The Muslim population is growing. Credible estimates put the number, Ethiopia is 80 million strong. So half of the population is Muslim. Mm-hmm. What is happening is that the regime is trying to impose on the peaceful Muslims of Ethiopia, a strange sect called Al-Ahbash, which is alien to the culture. And they reject it. They reject this interference in their religious affairs. They want hands off. And they have been protesting for quite a long time. But a week ago, an unprecedented huge number turned in the streets of Addis Ababa to protest against this. They were crushed brutally as usual, right under the nose of the African Union summit, while all the African leaders, the presidents and prime ministers, were gathered. So this was quite an embarrassment.
I would think so. Elias, if this took place in Addis Ababa, what would be the demographics of that city in relation to the religious confessional outlook?
I would say the same, 50-50, if not more.
In the city?
Yes, but in the Western mainstream media, Ethiopia is, of course, constantly portrayed as an island of Christianity, surrounded by a lake of Arab Muslim population. But the reality is that the Muslim population in Ethiopia is, significantly large, if not a majority. But that's not important. These two religions in Ethiopia, and the same goes for Eritrea, which is more or less the same percentage, have been coexisting peacefully. But the regime is now poking its nose where it doesn't belong.
Yes, you say they wish to impose a particular school. Now, who is the? Why would they do that? What would be the politics, or if I could put it so vulgarly, of that religious school?
The politics is that this strange sect, in fact, it's not within the mainstream Sunni faith. It is a sort of cult. But the reason they are doing that is that they believe they can control the affairs of the Muslim population easily that way.
Boy, they are playing with fire, aren't they?
Indeed, they're playing with fire, and the Ethiopian population, even the Christian population, supports this unwarranted interference in the internal affairs of, a predominant mainstream religion.
Oh, by the way, are there any external actors in this who are aiding and abetting the government of Ethiopia on this tactic, religious tactic?
Well, the external actor, one of the major backers of the regime, is a Saudi billionaire called Alamoudi.
I recognize that group, yes.
Yes, and he, I believe, is in cahoots with the elite of the ruling regime. Mm-hmm. And for that, he's rewarded plentifully and allowed to loot the wealth of Ethiopians. Mm-hmm. And Ethiopian opposition in the diaspora is, in fact, zeroing on him because, he funds the regime's, politics, the regime's investment affairs. Mm-hmm. He's in cahoots with the wife of Meles Zenawi in many shady business deals. So he's, the major backer in this regard.
Yeah, this is Elias Amari, and now speaking of this figure who is really holds together that peculiar regime, an ally of the U.S. and the Saudis, President Meles, he's not been seen. There's rumors he's terribly ill. Would you know anything about that?
Well, credible sources are saying that he's under critical condition, if not terminal. The regime, of course, is trying to cover that. At first, almost 2 months ago, they poo-pooed it and denied that nothing is happening to his health. He's in good condition, but he's been absent from the media, which he, of course, dominates on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Now he's reported to be undergoing treatment at Brussels Hospital called St. Luke.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't look good at all.
That would be a big problem for Washington, wouldn't it?
definitely the...
I have to ask you about this. Thomas Mountain has a piece in Counterpunch, the editor of which has just passed away. We're going to talk about it later, but now...
Yes, loss of Alex Coburn, yes.
Yes, a great loss. Now, Thomas Mountain wrote that the CIA is coming in almost to the extent of a hands-on running of the operation on behalf of the President Melis.
Yes, they are worried in Washington that their major, client state in Africa. Now, Melis Zenawi was the most trusted puppet leader in Africa for them. He's been feted and wined and dined in various circles in the West, even given awards and what have you. So they are worried. They have all the right to be worried because all bets were on him to stay longer. Though Washington knew in advance of his critical illness, WikiLeaks had reported, that as far back as 2006 they were aware of his illness, and some say that it's some sort of cancer that he has been undergoing for treatment.
Well, this is a severe crisis. If each of these things you've outlined for us points to trouble, because Ethiopia is a major U.S. ally in its operations in Somalia and in the region.
Indeed, next to the former Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak, Melis Zenawi was the most trusted ally for Washington and their European allies. They've been financing the regime to the tunes of billions of dollars every year with aid money, military aid, and what have you. Ethiopia is considered as a client state, an anchor state in that region to control the whole region of East Africa and Horn of Africa. They're worried because uncertainty looms large. Now, what is happening inside Addis Ababa is that there is a fierce power struggle, despite the cover of calmness they portray on the outside. The regime's elite are at a loss. What will happen after Melis Zenawi? And so, as opposition grows, as demonstration grows every day, there is increasing instability and worrying from Washington about what will happen to their most trusted client state.
Well, I take all that as encouraging. Elias Amari, we're really glad we're talking to you. We're going to be seeing you up here in August, we understand.
Yes, I look forward to that. But if I may plug in that at
Please.
The same time, the U.S. imposed sanctions against Eritrea also is something to closely examine. The UN has been examining the case, and the Security Council is soon to meet on what will happen to the sanctions that are unfair sanctions that were imposed against Eritrea. The only stable and peaceful nation in the region, so it's something to closely watch.
We are definitely going to do that, and we look forward to seeing you, and thank you very much for all the information.
Thank you, Phil. Look forward to connecting with you again.
Good. All right. Elias Amari, and we're very glad to be talking to him. This is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. It's a Taylor Report. You can check us out, taylor-report.com. And you can write to us, taylor@caut.fm. And while I'm talking about things that you can do, we're now in this internet world, so I would urge folks in talking about the developments in Syria, for example, to please make an effort to know what each party is saying. You don't have to go far to know what Hillary thinks. You just watch CNN, CBS, CBC, you'll find out that. But you have to work a little bit if you want to know what the position of the Syrian government. It's a sovereign state supported by other sovereign states. It has a right to defend itself, particularly against monarchies who are sending armies and hired mercenaries against them. And they have a site, it's called Sana, SANA.SY. It's a government-style site, But any self-respecting person who claims to care about the issues has to know what they say in their own behalf, not what somebody in the New York Times or the Toronto Star would like you to think they said. You need to know what they said. We're in an information war, and as they pointed out today, it's being jacked up. The U.S. and the Saudis and the Qataris, for whom the Toronto Star editorial writers seem to be semi-employed, they're being beat out of their wages if they're not. But they all repeat things from those folks. But those guys are organizing an effort to knock out the media communications. And even to hijack them, to make false reports on their programming. So then what they're going to do, they will hijack a program, for example. They will fake a story, and then Western leaders will respond to the fake story. And before you know it, a bunch of people have been hurt. So I really urge you, S-A-N-A, Sana, one word, .sy. And if you have my experience, you'll find that you can't always get it. Somebody here isn't terribly excited about you finding out for yourself because, freedom really shouldn't be extended to the citizens. Freedom's only to be embodied by the Queen and her employees or whatever they are. Anyhow, so that's very important stuff, in my opinion. Let's remark on the death of Alexander Coburn, one of the great journalists who died on Saturday in a hospital in Germany where he's being treated for cancer. A very hard-fighting, smart, able journalist, and he came to the United States from Britain. He was part of the, let's call it, 60s, very, very savvy guy. But of course he would be. He's the son of Claude Coburn, and Claude Coburn was part of the sharpest knife in the box, as they like to say. Throughout World War II, and actually during the Spanish Civil War, Claude Coburn was one of the guys. If you wanted to know what was going on in the world, you had to go to him. He had his own newsletter. And he's also the author of the novel Beat the Devil, which was turned into a great film. He didn't write the script for that. That was written by Truman Capote. Can you talk about weird luck? And it acted by Humphrey Bogart to get the whole picture. But Coburn's website, Counterpunch, and I would please go to that site, has got a very nice appreciation of who he is and was, written by his colleague, I think it's Mr. St. Clair. And Coburn was noticeably different than North American journalists in that he was not afraid to talk about the Israeli phenomenon in politics, both domestic but also in the Middle East. He was highly critical of Israel, and he was supportive of the Palestinians, but the forum he created was all kinds of voices. It's not one voice, several. But you had to go to the Counterpoint site, and I assume that will continue to be the case, to get really savvy commentary. And, of course, as a result of his position, his name got linked to that of a man who passed away not so long ago, Christopher Hitchens, because Christopher Hitchens and Alexander Coburn had been close friends at one time. They both wrote for The Nation magazine. But The Nation magazine increasingly went to be kind of a liberal Democrat apologist, and Hitchens. He went way to the right. With after the so-called 9/11 phenomena, Hitchens decided to throw in his lot with the most powerful people in America. He traveled around in their helicopters, visited in Iraq. I don't know if he pulled the trigger and killed anybody, but he wanted to, and. People thought of him as a radical. Here he was right in the hip pocket of the assault of those assaulting Iraq and everybody else. He joined in on the Islamophobic exercise. And his idea of being a radical was to tell the world he was an atheist. And somehow he thought that that was a sign of what a radical guy he was. But as Alexander Coburn pointed out, that's the type of radicalism that lets you remain employed by Vanity Fair for your whole life. You're not going to get in any trouble with that position, particularly if you're throwing rocks at Arabs. There's bonuses in that. Alexander Coburn had once been with the Village Voice. That's when I first noticed him. He did a thing called Press Clips. It was one of the smartest press commentary columns I ever saw. And like a lot of people, if you check around, everybody used to read that. He had a co writer, and I'm sorry, if I apologize to the gentleman. I cannot think of his name at this moment. But Coburn has had a particularly sharp sting, as they say. He had a great command of language, and he was grounded. He had a class point of view. He was, I would call him just basically a classic Marxist, actually, but very, very savvy. And by the way, he had the blue blood stuff, which he liked to play that card. He was related to, somehow or another, to Evelyn Waugh, the novelist, or at least was chummy with him. And he was in possession of a letter written by Evelyn Waugh, who was a darling of, as you know, of right-wingers. I don't know that he should be, because actually he's a kind of very subversive right-winger. But many just, you know, doted on him. There's a kind of American conservative that wants to be an Englishman. And one of those was William Buckley. And Buckley just, you know, he had the smirk and he had the accent, but he didn't have the brain. And so he wanted to be like Evelyn Waugh. So his collected letters of Waugh came out. And Buckley and others fought to exclude one of the letters, because the letter said, there's some American idiot named Buckley keeps coming to my door. Who is this moron? I'm paraphrasing, but he deserves it. But anyway, and of course, it was a right wing wannabe who said, you know, oh, you're the father of, you know, whatever it is. And so, Coburn made sure that everybody found out about the letter. That's kind of, you know, I enjoyed that. Counterpunch is a great site. And we, by the way, I used to use a joke. I said, well, we poach on that, because we do. We read Counterpunch, you know, and to see. And very often, people who write there, we talk to them, including Coburn himself. We had Coburn on a couple of occasions. I enjoyed it. I recall one interview with him where he was obviously eating lunch. And so I tried to pause while he was chewing, or rather tried not to pause, but it had a funny sound to it. He was a great guy, I liked his attitude. He was at work. It was pointed out he'd had cancer for quite a long stretch, and was doing his best, him and his doctors. And what he told his co-editor was, you know, don't worry about me. So far, I've only missed one deadline. Because he does, if you go into his collected columns, he did a weekend column. Everybody read those. People will tell you they didn't. Yes, they did, because he was good at gossip, and he was good at identifying things. He really had a great time with the people who turned on Ralph Nader. Actually, that was the best interview we had with him. I said to him, what happened with Michael Moore? Because Michael Moore, on one occasion, supported Nader and opposed the Democrats. Somehow or another, because it all got messy in the election, they all lost their nerve. And so the next time there was an election, Michael Moore and this comedian Maher, Bill Maher, actually ambushed Ralph Nader on a TV show and sat on bended knee and begged him not to run. Please, oh, you'll destroy the whole world. You know, if you run, you know, the Americans will have an imperialistic government and they'll bomb people if you vote for Nader. And so, Coburn, we asked him about that, and he said, well, you know, I remember when Michael Moore, when he got fired at Mother Jones, and he said he was out of pocket and out of luck, and he said the people who supported him were me and Ralph Nader. So he said, of course he remembers his old friends, doesn't he? I thought that was very edifying. I appreciated his remarks.
And didn't Michael Moore end up pumping a general to lead the Democrats?
Yes, and Michael's problem is that he's too much of an insider. Yeah. He's always trying to. He's kind of like a guy who says, "You're going to need a Catholic on the ticket." You know that? No. Please, we all understand that part. He got the idea that if you're going to be a liberal, you need to have a liberal with four stars on his chest. And you know, they ended up playing that card with Kerry, and Kerry sank like a boat. He got swift boated. And that's the way. But Moore thought, oh, if you have a war record, are you aware? Do you remember there was a Vietnamese veteran, a woman who lost both her legs, I think, in Vietnam, and she's a liberal Democrat, And she was decorated for heroism and every other thing. She ran as a liberal Democrat in Ohio, and they murdered her. The right wing murdered her. So you get this idea that people respect your medals? No, they don't. I mean, and one of the things we're going to be talking about with Cynthia Hess von Kreutner is that people claim that, oh, we honor all those men in uniform. No, no, you don't. You honor some of them. You're liars. You're hypocrites. You do not honor the uniform. You don't honor the medals. You don't. You're lying. And get lost. I mean, that's why people who served in the military get pretty tired of hearing this stuff. Because it's just an act. It's a guy saying, you know, vote for me. I like a guy in uniform. No, you like some of the guys in uniform. And maybe you like them a little too much, actually. But anyhow, it's that's a phenomenon. But anyway, I can't say it strongly enough. It's like losing a good soldier. I mean, let's put it this way. He's like I'd call him a commander, a mid-level commander. Guy had a good view. He had saw the entire battlefield. He knew tactics. He was, and he had an eloquent way of rallying the troops. And so when you lose one of those, you lost him. Don't pretend you didn't lose him. You lost him. And you better train up some folks. I really wish Counterpunch well. Everybody ought to work very hard to make sure that Alexander Coburn's great creation, Counterpunch, continues to be a success. I think we'll take a break. This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the Taylor Report, and we'll be back and talk to Cynthia Hess von Kreutner shortly. Thanks. And we're back, just like I warned you. And this is the Taylor Report. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And you can also check us out on the web at taylor-report.com. And I think I told you earlier, I'm going to tell you again, if you have any self-respect, it's kind of important these days. One of the great qualities of Charles Roach, and I wanted to say it, yes, I gave one of the speeches. It was not remarkable in any way, but I wish I had said, among other things, that Charles has a very serious malady, and it's called self-respect. And it's awful to have it, but it will bring you a lot of insight in the world when people think they can humiliate you or get you to sign things or make you act like a dog when you're not a dog. And if you have some self-respect, you do not obey when the master says we're going to attack Syria or Syria is our enemy. You say, show me the evidence, hotshot. I have a brain. I have two eyes. If you got some evidence, you bring it to me. But by the way, don't mouth the words of your words. Let me know what the other guy says. So that's kind of crucial. And I'm going to give you that site again. It's sana.sy. But now we are joined by Cynthia Hess von Kreutner. Are you there?
I am.
Hey, it's nice to talk to you. And of course, the anniversary that we're approaching, the 25th of July, is not a pleasant memory, but we are all very pleased that you have weathered a very difficult episode, and you have helped us in Canada. And by the way, I want to say that particularly on behalf of people who serve in the Canadian military. I hope they're all listening, and any veterans, to appreciate what happens when you put on that uniform and you go to serve your country and do as your husband did, Major Petta Hess von Kreutner, who was serving our country, Canada, in the at a UN post in Lebanon. Can you tell us now, we're approaching this date, what happened there and how it has unfolded in your view?
Certainly. First of all, I would like to thank you for your ongoing interest in this particular story. You know, in the news often events occur and we hear about it for, you know, a couple of days and then we're on to the next news item naturally. But you've been very supportive, and I really would like to thank you for that, first mm-hmm. of all. But yes, I would like to go over what happened. And I thought I'd point out that this UN mission originated in 1978. So it was in place for about 28 years, and this particular post, which is the Kayem post, mm-hmm. UN post, it's the oldest, and it's the best marked of the posts. It's up high on a plateau. I was never there, but I've certainly seen enough pictures to know it was out exposed and very visible. So moving forward, July 12, 2006 was when the war broke out in Lebanon, and Peta, my husband, and three others that he worked with, Hans, Ju, and Yarno, were involved in that war at the post for 14 days. So from the 12th to the 25th, when the bombing took place, that particular post reported 52 firing close and 2 firing in. So it meant that artillery or aerial bombs either were firing too close to the post or actually firing right into the post itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there were only 5 days of the 14 in which they didn't report any operational activities at all. Now, prior to the 25th, that post, there were 14 aerial bombs that were within 500 meters and 19 artillery rounds that impacted at 150 meters to that post. So it wasn't
hearing about it, weren't we? I mean, it was broadcast. The whole world was hearing that these shells were falling and the bombs were falling close to that post.
Oh, very close. You know, on one call, I could hear it in the background. And not only that post, but the other post as well. Also, same sorts of things happened to them as well. So on that particular day, on the 25th, at 12:11 to 1:35, for about an hour and 25 minutes, there was artillery and aerial bombs that hit in and around the post. And then from 2:18 to 2:49, so for 25 minutes, there was again another attack. And this time there were protests made to the IDF. And in fact, that day there were over 10 calls made directly to the Israelis. And you can see through news articles and reports that those calls went straight up the chain of command, because they would make a call to the Israelis, they would respond, but they wouldn't do anything.
They acknowledged receipt of the message,
but didn't do anything.
But made no correction.
No correction whatsoever. They didn't cease what they were doing.
Did they ever ask that that post be abandoned? Did they say, you have to leave? We're giving you a certain amount of time to leave that post?
No, but
because military, you know, if you have an honest engagement, very often military will say that. We have to tell all civilians in the region, or we tell the authorized personnel to now depart. We're going to give you a window.
Mm-hmm. That did happen later in the day, but not because the Israelis asked for an evacuation. The UN was putting together an evacuation. So they made protests to the Israelis, and again, they just acknowledged but didn't respond at all in any way. And then at 6:29, there were 12 artillery rounds that impacted near the post, and then 4 that actually impacted the post itself. So it hit the building itself. Mm-hmm. And that's when they could hear the guys in the post. There was a real change in their mood. That's when they knew they were in deep trouble. There was a possibility that that was going to be the end for them, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So then the chief of OGL contacted the Israelis and said, quote, "Unmo's lives are at risk," meaning the men that are in the post, their lives are at risk. Mm-hmm. So he made it very clear their position. There was extensive damage done to the bunker door, so the base was deemed no longer safe, and they made a decision to evacuate. So the UN decided that they would be evacuated, but they would be evacuated the following day at 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided that because the situation might be less tense, that they had to coordinate this evacuation through the network. So meaning UN was getting in contact with the Israelis, making sure they knew that they were going to be evacuating, clearing roads via the Israelis, stating, you know, they're going to take this route back. Don't bomb in that area. We give you, you know, and the Israelis would say, we'll give you so much time to get down that road, just as you stated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what they were putting together.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted them to do this during daylight. Now, when the bombing took place, it was that night, and it was very bright, so I don't know why they had to wait for daylight, because it was. So there was further contact with the Israelis to halt the attack, which included the force commander himself. So there had been at least over 10 calls made at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Then at 6:30 to 7:15, there was just a short reprieve where nothing happened. And then there were reports at 7:15, 7:16, and 7:17 that, again, close firing. So at 7:25, the closest post, OPMAR, relayed the evacuation order to the men at the post at Kayam. And, of course, they could hear that they were relieved. And they then stated there would be another radio check for 7:30, so in 5 minutes. And when they tried to make radio contact, of course, there was no contact at all.
Mm-hmm. And so what had happened?
Well, of course, they had bombed the post. They had went through and bombed the post, regardless of all the information that the Israelis had.
Could you describe that bomb? By the way, I think people don't have to understand. You pointed out there was shelling, which
yes.
they had been talking about for a long time with
yes.
no response from the Israelis. Then there was bombing, and this particular bomb was a nasty weapon. It's a laser-guided, right?
That's right.
500-pound bomb.
Well, they had been using artillery, and they had been using aerial bombs on the post. And that post is meant to withstand that sort of attack, which it did for the most part. But they didn't stop, and finally there was damage. The bomb that they used, the last bomb that they used was a laser-guided bomb. That's my understanding. It's a bunker buster, so that is meant to kill people in a bunker.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our listeners we are speaking to Cynthia Hess von Kreudner. Her husband, the major, was killed there in southern Lebanon on July 25th, 2006. I have to say, and maybe we should probably remark something about your husband and the others. There were three others, I believe, killed
right.
as well from Finland, China, and Austria.
Mm-hmm.
These are professional soldiers with great courage and skill. These were all officers, but I don't think many people without training could take shelling and bombing, even knowing that, you know, well, that thing is supposed to hold up.
Mm-hmm.
That is a remarkable, these are remarkable individuals.
Yeah, they were high, that was the one comment someone made to me. These weren't low-ranking people. These were high-ranking officers with, you know, loads of experience. And they were professional till the bitter end.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I read through.
I hope every Canadian soldier hears this, because people seem to distinguish soldiers in different roles. But once you're under fire, that's where you find out what kind of soldier you are. And he was under terrific fire without the ability to fire back.
That's right. He was relying on the UN, the symbols and, you know, the UN, the protection of it, that something would happen, that the Israelis would recognize that.
Somebody in New York.
Somebody anywhere, you know, the person responsible for doing this, he was
yeah.
hoping on that. But you're right, under fire, it's a whole different ball game. And I've never seen Peter in those circumstances, but I have seen him in some tense situations.
Well, by the way, he was very experienced.
Yeah.
He had served in the Congo. He
yeah.
had served in Bosnia.
Yeah.
I do hope what people think about building a statue, because he put in a lot of service in important areas of conflict.
Yes. Well, there is a memorial in Lebanon that the UN have built. It's a monument to the four of them. And what they've done is they've taken an actual wall from the post and they've erected that in land close to where the bunker once was. And every year they hold a memorial there in honor of all of them. So there is that monument, which is very important to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Canadians, were concerned. There was shock. But we're politically divided and uncomfortable people, and we have very close ties with Israel. So we went through a peculiar round here. We did lose a major officer, and it was an embarrassing moment. But there was – the Defense Department had a board of inquiry, and they did issue a report. I'd like to tell our listeners, by the way, put in the name Major Peter Hess von Kreudner. You will be able to, with a little diligence, find the commentary. And I believe, is it the Defense Department? Is it still possible to see that inquiry report if they go?
You really have to search to find it.
We have talented listeners, so and I know that all the soldiers listening will do something.
Yes.
But now, So they had an inquiry, and also on some of these sites you will find a letter from yourself. There is a letter from Cynthia Hess von Kreuner. And you had some thoughts about it. What was your main take on that inquiry?
Well, I think they did the very best considering the circumstances in which, you know, the Prime Minister of Israel, again, you know, he made promises stating, first of all, that they wouldn't fire on that post and that they would protect that post. And
they did give an undertaking they wouldn't.
That's correct. To Kofi Annan, they mm-hmm. stated that it would be protected, UN personnel would not be targeted, when in fact that's exactly what happened, and other posts as well. He also stated that they would, and I have the quote here somewhere, where he stated that they would do a thorough investigation of the incident and they would share their findings with the UN, in which that thorough investigation was not shared with, it's closed. It is. There are certain findings that are shared with the Canadian government, but we did not get answers to every question that we had. We were not given access to the key personnel who could answer the questions as to why that post was bombed. We had a lot of questions unanswered.
Was there a difference on that? Was there any indication from the Canadian side that they were not satisfied with the response they were getting from the Israeli defense people?
I wasn't satisfied, and the board wasn't. They posed several questions to the Israeli, and again, they just didn't acknowledge, just like they wouldn't, you know, stop with the bombing of the post. They just simply mm-hmm. threw up their hands and said, we're just not going to respond, and that seems to work.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is so pertinent because we are the tensions in that region that your husband was acting as a UN observer to alleviate and prevent from getting worse are still there, and we're, as a matter of fact, as we're talking today, there's this kind of danger. There are UN personnel deployed at the moment in Syria and in the region. So it is important to Canadians to get to the bottom of these things, isn't it?
Yeah, because the problem is, in any circumstance where this sort of thing happens, I can't tell you the number of times I watch on TV, you know, when incidents happen. People want to know why. They want accountability. And they want to have justice for what happened. Why? Because it continues if we don't do anything about it. That's the key problem. And it is not to condemn anyone. It is not for fault-finding. That is not what this is about. It is so it doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. And certainly a Canadian officer of similar rank to your husband asked to do such a mission, I think, would be well within his rights to say, well, if you're going to deploy me there under the appropriate protocols, are you going to back me up when those protocols are violated?
I'm pretty sure, and if it's not the case, any officers who are listening, for heaven's sake, let that be an example to you because you are on your own.
Mm-hmm. A frightening thought. Now, you ask that others take this up. Incidentally, I have to say, I was looking today and I found, I think it's a Canadians for Justice and Peace yes. in the Middle East. They wrote a rather nice commentary, smart commentary, which is also available on the Internet, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. They were not satisfied with the Board of Inquiry. And I think you and they probably made the same statement. This should just be the beginning, right?
Yes, absolutely. We need to take this further. As I said, I've stated that to the Prime Minister as well. This needs to be the beginning. And we need to have answers to this, and it just simply hasn't happened. So,
mm-hmm. What about other agencies? You mentioned the United Nations Security Council. My memory is that the Secretary General was most unhappy.
Yes,
and
well,
made some very helpful statements at the time.
Yeah, he claimed that you know it was deliberate. You know, he said this is that he wrote that he was shocked. Deeply distressed by the apparent deliberate targeting by the Israeli Defense Force. This coordinated artillery and aerial attack on a long-established, clearly marked UN post at Qayyim occurred despite personal assurances given to me by the Prime Minister of Israel that the UN positions would be spared Israeli fire. Further, the UN force commander in southern Lebanon had been in repeated contact with the Israeli officers throughout the day, stressing the need to protect that particular UN post from attack.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very clear about it.
That is very clear.
Yeah.
again, this is Cynthia Hess von Kreutner. And I hope that – no, well, I should ask one other thing. The Security Council, did they ever revisit the events there? And did the UN issue a report?
Well, the UN did a board of inquiry as well, but I'm going to touch back on that. You're right, the Security Council did revisit that. I guess it was within days, and they demanded that by the United States that the statement had to be watered down, that they insisted on the dropping of condemning it, and that it was deliberately targeted. They would not allow Kofi Annan to use those remarks, but regardless, he had already stated it. It was already out there, and that is the statement that is remembered at this point. So the U.S. or whomever can do whatever. The point is that is exactly what happened. But the U.N. did do a board of inquiry. I've never had access to it, never been allowed to have access to it. I don't know any of the results of it, unfortunately.
Well, it sounds like something that we ought to encourage all military personnel and others to people behaving like appropriately as citizens to demand more information. We could use some light on this subject, and particularly in light of the events unfolding there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to admit that, you know, it has been difficult. I do plan to write the Prime Minister again because, you know, I want to know. He claims he's spoken to the Prime Minister of Israel about what happened. I'd like to know. I've never heard the results of that conversation. We've sent questions to the Israelis. I'd like to know what their response was, which would more than likely be that they haven't responded. Regardless, that's still a response. And I'd like to know what further information will be done about this, you know, with what they have, because this isn't all right for these things to continue on. There's somebody, the person was killed. And, you know, if a police officer is killed, a civilian is killed, others, something's done about it.
That's
but
right.
In this case, nothing is done. And I'd like to read one statement that was very important, I felt. Major General Terry Lifton, who was over in Lebanon at the time, this was what he had to say about it. He said, "The strength of any international peace force, particularly when unarmed, is the fact that it's the Blue Beret and it's the UN flag. It is backed by the full support of the international community, and in particular, countries contributing its soldiers to that force. The impact of our politician's statement has been to assure the belligerents that it is perfectly acceptable to kill unarmed peacekeepers such as Candace Courageous Major Peta Hess von Kreutner when they're in the way. Our Canadian politicians have been grossly disloyal to the heroes that they have put into such dangerous situations. And they continue to do that."
That's a great statement.
Mm-hmm. I think it really points out exactly what happened in this particular case.
Yeah. Well, as you have said, and because you have spoken up very, very serenely and eloquently, and we are all touched by that, this case is not closed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's my hope. I mean, I will have to write the Prime Minister to see what's going to happen, what he has to say, if anything. You know, I don't know where to go on this.
You're not alone in this effort. There are many people, but I know many military people who care about these things. I of course, on this show, I've interviewed some of the victims of the from the U.S. the incident of the U.S. intelligence ship, where they are seeking justice from their government because they came under attack and nobody ever did anything. So we have to do it on behalf of those who went out there doing their duty and suffered and found themselves neglected by their governments.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that is not an easy task to do. And the governments are aware of this, and I don't believe they make it easy in any way, shape, or form for anything to be done, of course.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Cynthia Hess von Kreutner, it's great to be talking to you. Thank you for keeping your spirits up. Your husband is definitely a Canadian hero. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Cynthia Hess von Kreutner. Listen, you can all do this. I did it. go to the write in the major's name. His name was Peta, P-A-E-T-A, Peta Hess von Kreutner. I think I'm saying Kreutner, and she's saying
I noticed she said Kreutner. Yeah, it's K-R-E-U.
Am I trying to show off some kind of Dutch ancestors? Mm-hmm. I don't know. My apologies.
You know, actually, you should spell the name for our listeners because it is a tough one.
Okay, you keep notes. I'm going to try to spell it.
All right.
Okay. Pet Major, you can all do that. Peta, P-A-E-T-A, Hess, H-E-S-S, hyphen, von, V-O-N, Kreutner, I'm spelling it K-R-E-U-D-E-N-E-R. I may have got it wrong.
That sounds right, but it's von or van.
I think I get a chocolate cookie for that. Yeah.
It's Van Kreutner with a V-A or a von with a V-O?
I'm sure. Well, now you see, that's a good way to throw the kid off who's trying to spell it. Can I consult my mother? I think it's Vaughn. Anyway, I tell you this. Thank goodness machines are smarter than we are. If you get as far as Major Peta, believe me, it'll all just pop up. But Cynthia Hess von Kreutner has written a very nice letter in response to this unhappy inquiry report. It's an unhappy in that it didn't really answer the questions it needed to be answered. It opened a lot of issues, but it didn't get to the bottom.
By the way, where are our opposition parties in our House of Commons on this? I mean, here you have a guy.
This is like after the Spanish guy fired a shot in the Spanish parliament. They said, where is everybody? And they were all under their desk. It's where they are because they are terrified. That was an ugly experience. If you go back and read the headlines and the weird goings on in the world, but particularly in Canada, it was stormy because the Israeli army stormed Jordan. Jordan, wrong country. Lebanon. Jordan next time. But Lebanon. And terrible loss of life. And of course, the various partisans were on their feet. And once they're on their feet with megaphones, it doesn't matter what comes out of their mouths. The main thing is to make noise. So that's what happened. But meanwhile, here is a UN post painted white with the letters UN on the side of it on a plateau that had been there for a mere 3 decades, gets hit with a laser directed 500-pound bomb. Killing a Finlander, a Chinese, Austrian, and a Canadian major. So it's an important story. But
there is too that Harper says that we're not the peacekeepers anymore. We're the guys getting in there and doing the tough stuff.
He says we're warriors. Yeah. By the way, warriors. That's a fatal thought. A soldier is not an attacker. A soldier defends his territory, or he assaults if necessary. Someone who defines himself as a warrior is a full-time assaulter. Full-time assaulters don't live very long. They might have an early 30 minutes, but after that, it gets a little less exciting. And so, he's got a primitive, non-military idea of what a soldier is. And that's because he never served anywhere, as far as I know. And so he's full of malarkey and likes to wear a helmet when he visits troops. You want to see a politician absolutely lose his mind, put a helmet on him. And he then turns into a little bubble of goody things about soldiers. It's just peculiar. As far as I'm concerned, if you've gone through boot camp, you can do that stuff. If you haven't, don't wear the helmet. Now, going back, though, to the Syria matter, and I hate to make a pun here, but there's a serious issue that now, every week we have we have some public relations outfit working with the Pentagon, which gives us a new issue. So the issue of the week is that they've decided that there are chemical weapons in Syria. That's in order to alarm people in London and New York so that they, because if it's kind of like someone saying there's a mouse in the room or there's a snake, that people just start screaming and swatting. So they put this problem onto Syria by saying, well, we're concerned. So Syria issued a statement saying, we would never, such weapons, never use them because, this is that they have, they're faced with an atomic power on their border, which is also occupying part of their territory, the Golan Heights, and laughs about it all the time. But at any rate, so Syrians say, well, this is a domestic matter. We have an uprising of being fed and armed by Washington and Paris, and no question, because each is bragging about how much they are working to violently subvert the sovereign state of Syria. So, but as soon as Syria made that statement, then they said, now you're threatening us. And they said, no, we're not threatening anybody. You guys raised the issue, but this is how the game is played. So the issue of the week is going to be, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So by Friday, because Friday, by the way, it always is fireworks time, and the armed terrorists operating inside Syria at the behest of Qatar and Washington, that would be the monarch of Qatar and Hillary Clinton or whomever, and they will have to have something. Something has to go bang. It has to be kind of fireworks every Friday. And then they have to announce that it looks like Assad is finished. And that is the game they're playing. They're trying to sort of set everybody up to panic their opponent. But, you know, if the opponent doesn't panic, things tend to play out differently. Hillary's in, the Pentagon is highest guy is in Israel now, and the subject is chemical weapons. So today is Monday. So by Friday, there will be talk of which of the two great powers will take out those weapons, or perhaps Turkey will intervene. Turkey is violating all international agreements. They're not respecting the border. The border, they are supposed to keep refugees only and not armed refugees, and you're not to allow armed refugees to cross your border. Turkey's bragging that that's what they do. That's of course, an act of war, but it's being carried out by a fat idiot who thinks that he can just bully, and so he doesn't care about the law. Anyway, we're coming close, I think, to the time here, but I'm going to say it again, sanasy. Get the straight goods from them. You may not agree with it, but at least you can honestly say to people, I did read what they said, because otherwise everything else you read is going to be what Hillary wants you to read or Harper wants you to read, and then you're going to come and give me a hard time, and I'm not interested in that. If you haven't read Sun, I'm not going to listen to you, because that means you don't know how to gather news. I'll remind you again, this is the Taylor Report, and you can get hear these programs such as today's at taylor-report.com, and you can write to us at taylor@ciut.fm. I think I'll be in the last moment. I'll congratulate the Toronto Star on the dumbest headline of the week. It was China underwater because there was rain in Beijing. China underwater. Suppose they try to headline Canada underwater. And would that work? People would say, but they think, it's China. We can do this. Anyway, that's why you got to listen to. You got to read The Counterpunch. We're very, very sorry about the loss of Alexander Coburn. And always support alternative radio. This is Phil Taylor for Phil Conlon and Carol. And thanks very much. And we will see you next week.